The United Nations calls the destruction of a critical Ukraine dam a monumental humanitarian, economic, and environmental catastrophe.
The floodgates of suffering have been overflowing for more than a year, and that must stop. Attacks against civilians and critical civilian infrastructure must stop.
Plus, how experts say Russia is managing to evade international sanctions by following the lead of another nation that's been under sanctions for years.
Iran, as a hydrocarbon economy trying to export oil, has learned a lot of tricks over the recent years that we do see Russia start to employ.
And later in the program, an award-winning documentary on the invasion of Mariupol is screened for the first time in Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, June 6th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. The wall of a major dam in a part of southern Ukraine that Moscow controls collapsed Tuesday, triggering floods, endangering Europe's largest nuclear power plant, and threatening drinking water supplies as both sides in the war rushed to evacuate residents and blamed each other for the emergency. I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for the very latest on this crisis.
So basically, over the night, one of the most horrible disasters happened in Ukraine in this war. This caused natural disaster, which is happening right now, the destruction of Kakhovka Dam, which is a Kakhovka hydro station. What we know for the moment, again, we cannot independently verify or confirm this information because the dam is under Russian control since the beginning of occupation of this territory. But we have official statements by the Ukrainian government and particularly by President Zelensky. So we will use these for this point and for this moment. So for the moment, Ukrainian authorities confirmed that the explosion happened from the inside. This looks quite realistic because the dam itself, the construction of the dam is very strong and it was built considering possible war attacks. So because this is extremely important construction, it's extremely important infrastructure facility, it's critical infrastructure facility. And it's impossible to destroy it with any missile. So explosion from the inside looks realistic.
Obviously, people are being evacuated. What about the energy situation as far as impact, the energy infrastructure?
For the moment, what we have, due to the damage of the Kakhovka Dam, we have flooding of the south part of Ukraine, basically, and particularly Kherson region. The area that suffers the most is left bank of the river, which is under Russian control. Right bank of the river, which is Kherson and deoccupied, liberated Kherson region, suffer less, but still there is quite a bad flooding there as well. Ukrainian authorities report evacuation of more than 1,000 people and the right evacuation trains going on from Kherson to other parts of Ukraine. Unfortunately, Ukrainian authorities confirmed that they cannot reach civil society on the left bank of the river because the connection was cut by the Russian forces which control the territory. But for the moment, we hear the reports of flooding in such cities, for instance, as Novakakhovka. So the city is just going under the water. It's still yet not completely under the water, but water level is getting pretty higher every hour. The dam itself is completely under the water already. President Zelensky already held national security meeting, and according again to the latest statement by the Prime Minister of Ukraine, Mr. Shmigal, the most important for the moment for Ukrainian authorities is to make sure that people are evacuated, also that people have enough drinking water because water, for the moment, water in Kherson region is extremely dirty. There are also reports confirmed by the president office that at least 150 tons of oil have reached the river due to the explosion. And also, Prime Minister of Ukraine confirmed that another main priority is to make sure that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is safe.
Right, of course, because it's this dam supply
supply some of the cooling water for the plant, and that could be a big disaster.
Yes, exactly. And in general, energy question is another, is one of the top priority questions, because not only because of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant cooling reservoir that was used as Kakhovka reservoir, but also because of Kherson thermal power plant. According to Ukrainian Ministry of Energy, Kakhovka thermal power plant could be flooded as well. For the moment, it's not, but the risk is extremely high. And we should understand that in terms of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the same. For the moment, situation is under control, but risks are very high because we are, well, for the moment, we're talking about natural disaster, and it's no one who can control or guide it or have any predictions on what might happen for sure.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, in a statement Tuesday, described the dam's destruction as a monumental catastrophe that is yet another devastating consequence of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Massive flooding, large-scale evacuations, environmental devastation, destruction of newly planted crops. And that is threats to the highly threatened Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest nuclear facility. At least 16,000 people have already fled their homes, lost their homes, with safe and clean drinking water supplies at risk for many thousands more.
And for more on the implications of this disaster, both ecologically and economically, I spoke with Anton Antonienkos, vice president of the Dixie Group, a Kyiv-based energy policy think tank.
What are the implications of what happened here for the economy, the ecology? How serious is this?
This is an unprecedented technological terrorist attack when the role of terrorist is played by the whole state, because it is the first time that we see that the technological progress of the society is not praised but used as a weapon in the war against civilians. We previously saw Russia using gas, using different sources of energy as weapon, but this is really unprecedented and a clear move from the Russian side. They knew the destruction of the dam and destruction of the hydropower plant would lead to people relocating, at least, would lead to multiple effects and would lead to actually disaster. Kakhovka hydropower plant was occupied from the very early days of war, full-scale invasion of the 24th of February, and it was also known that it's fully mined. And here I want to put a special stress, because when we think about stress testing or risk testing, the site such as hydropower plant, you would usually think about the disasters like the earthquakes or, for example, a terrorist. Well, when you think about the terrorist attack, you think about a very limited influence on the such construction as a dam, right? But you cannot think that the terrorists are they which can easily plan and implement blowing up of the whole structure, the dam itself, the operation unit, the administrative building, and so on. Because now that the dam and the hydropower plant were blown up from the inside, that means that the explosives were installed inside the hydropower plant.
Russia's accusing Ukraine of doing this, of sabotaging this.
This is absolutely ridiculous. Ukraine really has no bonus in doing this whatsoever. Just on the contrary, Ukraine takes care of every of its citizens. And as we saw, for example, when Russia was fought away from Kherson, it destroyed every source of electricity and heat in the cold. So this is typically their pattern of behavior. I know they're scared because this is a true war crime. And this also symbolizes and clearly shows that Russia is not after people. Russia is not interested in gaining people. It doesn't care about anyone, and it just wants to create genocide, and it wants Ukraine to disappear.
What are the ramifications of what has now happened? I understand it's definitely putting hundreds of thousands of civilians in dangers and affecting access to the cooling water at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. The ecological, what happens now that this is out of control?
Since it's really unprecedented, I'm afraid we will still have to see the implications. What we can project as of now is truly changing the nature, as polluting the natural conditions and ecosystems. For example, we already know that the transformer oil, as much as at least 150 tons, ended up in water. So it's right now polluting the water in the downside part down the river. Also, we've heard about Azov being flooded in Kherson. We can only project how the natural ecosystems will be changed in the areas that are located down the river. But the effect, of course, will be massive because it's a massive amount of water moving down the river in the areas where it was not projected to be. It also would include, for example, wastewater, all kinds of technological damage. There is also a big aspect of agri, as you rightfully mentioned, clean water use for a number of Ukraine territories, of course, as well. The way the flood will go and maximize, we currently don't know. I would only add that implications are multiple. There are economic implications. We already, I think, have seen the grain prices going up internationally. It has energy implications. Of course, the hydropower plant was working off the Ukrainian network since it was occupied. However, it is exactly the green energy generation that Ukraine will be needing for the reconstruction. And I think it is very important to make this stress that Ukraine will rebuild. It will rebuild green, and Russia will have to pay for all that damage that it has caused. And the money Ukraine will receive as reparations will also go to rebuild this hydropower plant, make it new and flexible source of green energy for Ukraine.
Anton Antonenkos, vice president of the Kyiv-based think tank Dixie Group. The United States imposed sanctions on Monday on members of a Russian intelligence-linked group for their role in Moscow's effort to destabilize democracy and influence elections in Moldova. Meanwhile, Russia's copying Iran's tactics in trying to evade Western sanctions, according to a report from the Royal United Services Institute. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
Western nations have imposed successively tougher sanctions on Russia since its full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Sunday that Russia is circumventing these measures. The Ukrainian president said, unfortunately, the terrorist state manages to obtain the technologies of the world through a network of suppliers, manages to bypass international sanctions. Russia is learning to adapt to the sanctions, says Tom Keating, author of the RUSI report.
In particular, sourcing the kind of electronic components they need to support their military. That's the first thing. The second thing is obviously they've had to look for new markets for their hydrocarbons, their oil exports. That's a key revenue generator for the country.
Russia says its economy shrank by 2.1% in 2022, less than many expected. Meanwhile, imports of Russian crude oil by China and India hit an all-time high in May. That's partly because the sanctions apply only to Western governments and companies trading with Russia. Again, Tom Keating.
And therefore, if you're a bank in India, you can perfectly well have a financial connection with a Russian bank.
Nevertheless, most global trade is still conducted in US dollars. So how has Russia circumvented attempts to strangle its economy? Keating says the Kremlin is increasingly looking to Iran as a model of how to evade sanctions. Tehran has been subject to various Western sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs and its support for terrorist groups, which Iran denies. Again, Tom Keating.
Iran, as a hydrocarbon economy trying to export oil, has learnt a lot of tricks over the recent years. that we do see Russia start to employ. So, for example, shadow fleets of tankers. So these kind of switching oil between tankers in the middle of the night with location devices switched off, but also using front companies in places like Turkey or the UAE to try and hide the origin of trade.
The two countries have also begun connecting their financial systems to facilitate transactions outside the global SWIFT payment system. Last month, Russia's second largest bank, VTB, opened an office in Tehran. How can Ukraine's allies prevent Russia evading the sanctions? The private sector is the front line of compliance, notes Keating.
The private sector has had to scramble to get itself in a position to ensure that it knows who its customers are, it knows who it's exporting things to, it knows what's allowed and what's not allowed. And so the result is that there are huge gaps in the system.
The report urges the West to educate the private sector on detecting illegal trades. It warns that Moscow will increasingly seek to use Iran's playbook as it tries to circumvent sanctions. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
Turkey's newly re-elected president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is facing the challenge of balancing ties with Russia and Western allies. Ankara's ongoing veto of Sweden's NATO membership bid is a critical test of its loyalties, and analysts suggest Erdogan may be looking for a reset with Washington. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan takes his presidential oath for a third time, as analysts predict foreign policy will be a priority in Erdogan's bid to make Turkey a 21st century power. Asla Aydintashbash of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
We're also likely to see a continuation of this non-aligned strategic autonomous idea of Turkey's place in the world. President Erdogan sees Turkey as a rising power. He's built his campaign on this 21st century, he says, will be the century of Turkey. And that Turkey is not a loyal card-carrying member of the transatlantic community.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, attending Erdogan's swearing-in ceremony, lobbied Turkey to lift its veto of Sweden's membership bid when leaders of the alliance hold a summit next month. Stoltenberg says Stockholm has addressed Ankara's calls to crack down on terrorist groups that target the Turkish government.
Important new terrorism legislation has come into force just a few days ago. So Sweden has fulfilled its obligations.
Ankara's opposition to Sweden's membership bid comes as Ankara pledges to deepen ties with Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin was among the first to congratulate Erdogan's latest electoral success. Hussein Baja is the head of the Foreign Policy Institute, an Ankara-based research organization.
Good friends, live through, and Turkish-Russian relations for the next 5 years will continue to be stronger. Putin is definitely very happy that he has his friend as president again for another 5 years.
Putin gave Erdogan significant financial support during his presidential election, deferring billions of dollars in energy payments to support the beleaguered Turkish economy. But analysts suggest Erdogan could be looking to consolidate his electoral success with a diplomatic reset with Washington. Seha Güvenç is a professor of international relations at Kadir Has University.
Erdogan got what he wanted or what he needed before the elections from Russia. Now, probably his expectations are more centered in the West than in Russia. Probably Erdogan and his associates will seek reinvigoration of the relations between the two countries on the basis of a better reception of Erdogan in Washington, D.C., probably an official visit. This is what they're expecting.
Improved Turkish-U.S. relations may help ease financial pressures facing Turkey's economy. But some analysts warn that the poor chemistry between the country's two leaders remains an obstacle. Asla Aydintashbash of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
Turkey is a challenge for Washington, and it will continue to be a challenge the relationship is less than ideal. In fact, it's pretty dysfunctional. It starts at the top with Presidents Erdogan and President Biden hardly talking or hardly ever meeting.
A U.S.-Turkey reset could depend on Ankara's stance on NATO enlargement and growing Western calls to impose sanctions on Russia, something with which Erdogan has refused to go along. Doreen Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Russians who fear persecution due to their opposition to Moscow's war on Ukraine continue to seek asylum in the United States after the White House announced a new policy back in September. Many are coming through Mexico. Nina Vishneva reports on a mother and her three children who made that journey. Anna Rice narrates the story.
Since arriving in New York City, Tatiana, who came to the U.S. with her three children after Russia invaded Ukraine, has been joining rallies in support of Ukraine and political prisoners in her home country. Tatiana, who asked VOA not to use her last name, brought her two daughters to this rally. Anya, her middle child, drew a poster and a letter in which she apologizes for what Russia has done in Ukraine.
I live in New York now because of what is happening in my country, because it invaded Ukraine. I am ashamed for my motherland.
Tatiana never dreamed of coming to the U.S., and definitely not under these circumstances.
I didn't want to come to the U.S. I never planned to leave even my city, let alone the country. But I just had to.
Tatiana left St. Petersburg and entered the U.S. through the border with Mexico. Her oldest son recently turned 19 and had registered with Russia's military. Leaving was a way to save him from serving. Tatiana's husband had to stay in Russia. The pace of Russian arrivals to the U.S. more than doubled after the White House announced that war objectors would be eligible for asylum. Tatiana says conditions in Russia were dangerous and terrifying.
When we came to an anti-war protest, it was scary. Police would grab everyone. I was crying, screaming. Policemen grabbed me and my friend and took us to a police van. But I got lucky. An acquaintance who worked at Special Task Police recognized me and freed me and my friend. I remember him shouting, "Get out of here, quick!" He was later fired for doing this.
Tatiana's children have been going to a New York school for just a couple of weeks. They are the only ones in their classes who speak Russian, but they have faced no bullying or problems. While the kids are in school, Tatiana is learning English. She plans to get a driver's license and a work authorization. She hopes to start her own business. She also hopes to receive official refugee status, even though she understands that the process, as well as finally reuniting with her husband, will likely take years. Despite hardships and sorrow, Tatiana says the U.S. feels free and welcoming. For Nina Vishneva in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
An award-winning documentary on the invasion of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol is screened for the first time in Ukraine. We hear more from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma. The Russian
sign of war. 20 Days in Mariupol made its premiere in Ukraine on Saturday, watched by some of the Ukrainian medics and first responders who were chronicled in the documentary about how Russian forces bombed and blasted their way into the southeastern port city last year. The AP's Mstislav Chernov, who directed the film, says he was deeply moved by viewers' reactions at the Kyiv screening.
It was so emotionally devastating for me to see tears of Ukrainians, to see tears of those who have been with us, those thanks to who we survived.
For some, the screening served as an unsettling flashback to their own brush with death in the city. Chernov says,
"This is a history of Ukraine."
I'm Charles Duledesma.
And that'll do it for us today, but stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.